Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring your hosts, Heisey Lutmers and Charlie Harrington.
The Amethyst Oracle.
Delve into life, death, and everything betwixt, between, and beyond.
Between and beyond.
Between and beyond.
With a queer twist.
The Amethyst Oracle. Divination with a queer twist. And now, here are your hosts, Charlie Harrington and Heisey Lutmers.
And welcome to the show, everyone. Thank you for joining us this evening. This is High C, and I will be joined here momentarily by my co-host, Charlie Harrington. We're very excited tonight because our guest is someone that both of us admire and look up to, and are kind of one of those, you know, stellar presences in the tarot world, and that is, of course, Rachel Pollack. So we're very excited about our conversation with her in just a little bit. Just a little housekeeping as we start. I want to let you know that you can certainly call in or Skype in if you would like to receive a reading from us on the air this evening. We'll be doing that a little later in the show. You can Skype in from the show page, or you can call 646-716-5510. That's 646-716-5510, and that phone number is also on the show page if you need it to refer to. And you can also find us on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/theamethystoracle. And one reason you might want to find that Facebook page is because if you're on the email list for the Firefly Willows Live channel, you will have seen that you have an opportunity to listen and win, which means that, and this is pretty much for all of the shows on the Firefly Willows Live channel, so there's lots of opportunity to win different things, whether it's a free reading, it might be a book, or other things. So it's worth being on the email list because it gives you the chance to win some things, and all it takes is listening to the show. And so to do that, for tonight's show, for example, you want to listen to the show. There's a question that was on the email that came out, so you want to listen and see what it is that, what is the name of the Lenormand-based deck that Rachel Pollack and Robert Place are working on. And if you have that answer and you go to our Facebook page and you're the first person to post a comment with the answer to that, then you will receive a free 15-minute tarot reading with me, High C. That is the prize that you have to look forward to for this particular show. So listen for that and then visit our Facebook page. And also I would say if you aren't on the email list for Firefly Willows Live and you'd like to be, either on the Facebook page for Amethyst Oracle or the Facebook page for Firefly Willows Live, which is just facebook.com/fireflywillows, just post a comment saying that you'd like to subscribe, or send us a message if you don't want to put your email address in the comments. You can just send a private message on either of those pages, and we'll make sure to get you added to the email list. So there are our little housekeeping details, and now let me go ahead and welcome to the show my co-host, Charlie Harrington. Are you there, Charlie?
Hey, I know the answer to the question. Can I win the free reading?
Well, you could, but then you might have to apply for asylum in Venezuela.
Oh, that's true.
Because that kind of cheating and treachery will not be tolerated on this show.
No, or on these shores. It's good to be back on the air. How are you, my dear?
I am doing well. Hopefully you've had an enjoyable month and you had an enjoyable Pride celebration.
Well, how could I with everything that Saturn is doing?
Well, Saturn is actually doing some good things.
Oh.
Were you out and about for Pride festivities?
I was out, and I'm not sure what it was about, but it was wonderful. The energy was up this year, as we imagined, so it was a great time for me. And you as well.
It is true. I had heard that, because both of us were at San Francisco, and 1.5 million people, they say, came into the city for the celebration and the parade and everything on Sunday.
Unrelated
this year,
to us being there, of course.
Well, maybe 500,000 of those unrelated. But the rest of them, I think, got wind that we would be there.
We might.
Wanted to make sure that we would, that they were, you know, in the vicinity to try and catch a glimpse.
Or
well, I'm sure they would have pestered us. It's true. But we're always happy to be pestered for such a thing, aren't we?
Desperate, actually, is the word I would use.
Yeah, well, now, let us not start getting into your counseling session of your life.
Anyway, it was a wonderful pride. I had an excellent time. And there weren't any readers there, unfortunately. At big festivals like that, it just makes no sense to me. So I think you and I should do what we do best and fill a void. I fill the void.
Well, this is what I've heard of you. And we have been talking about starting to do that and perhaps start having some booth space to do readings at various festivals and things like that, now, haven't we? So hopefully Amethyst Historical will start being a bit of a presence at those festivals. Mm-hmm. And if anyone's in the San Francisco area, you might keep an eye out, because you might just see us there doing readings if you're out and about for those things, which I think would be very fun.
It really would.
Now, Charlie, you have mentioned Saturn.
I did. It was an inelegant segue, and I apologize.
Oh, pish posh, pish posh.
All right.
We're nothing if not inelegant.
True.
And fortunately, Saturn is going direct, which just means if you were looking at it in the sky, it has been retrograde since the very early part of the year. And it would look like it was going backwards, and now it's starting to go direct, which just means it would look like it's going forwards. But what that does is it affects or it indicates what's happening with the energy of that planet at a particular time. Most people know Mercury retrograde, which we're also in right now.
And now.
Yes. If you want big examples of that, just look at plane crashes in San Francisco and train derailments.
Oh, I mean
Canada.
Mercury. Anyway.
Mercury is being very dramatic this particular time. But with Saturn going direct, so what we may have found over the past few months with it retrograde is a sense of things that we may have been trying to do or set in motion or bring into being may have been getting hit with obstacles, delays, kind of getting bogged down and not able to really come together or move forward. And so with it going direct, this is a really, really good time for starting to reactivate projects, goals, etc., that either got put on hold at the beginning part of the year or have been getting a lot of delays and things and maybe caused us to start second-guessing whether they were going to happen or whether to keep putting energy into them. It's also a time where we start taking more responsibility, which can also mean just taking more responsibility for how we want things and how we want things to be moving forward. So, you know, this is a really great time to be thinking about what is it that got put onto the back burner or got set aside that I might now want to bring back out and start taking responsibility for creating and giving structure to and moving forward that I want to see goals around. Now, we probably won't see major fruition until the fall, but the key is to start going through the process now so that we can start to see that in the fall. That's kind of how long it'll take. There's a period called the shadow period when planets shift like this. And so for Saturn, that shadow period will kind of go through I think it's like October 14th or something like that. So it's not that things can't happen during the shadow period. It's just that we don't start to see the fullness of our efforts until after we're out of the shadow period, which is why we wouldn't see things coming into full fruition until the fall. But that will be a timeline based on what efforts and things that we're doing and foundations that we're creating for that right now. And mm-hmm. I will mention that on in addition to that, what we have going on this month especially and through the early part of August is something called a Grand Water Trine with Saturn and Neptune.
And bikini season, right?
It is. And it's a water trine because it's all water planets. I won't go into all of the details about it, but suffice it to say that a grand water trine, this it's a great time to be taking action because it's going to, one, challenge us to simply face our fears and realize they're not as scary or they're not as real as we give them credit for being, which may be what holds us back from doing things. Which then becomes the Saturn aspect of face the fear, move through it, and start doing those things you've been afraid of, and you may be very pleasantly surprised with the results that come. And the kind of the energy or the dynamic of a trine, and especially this trine, is really good for helping support and encourage or guide us in any important projects that we have going on. So this is a really key time to be putting projects to the forefront, moving them forward, putting actions into them, reactivating things that had gotten put on hold, especially over the past few months, because you will likely see great results and fruition from the amount of effort. And of course, it's relative to the amount of effort you put into something, but you will see great results from that. So to help people, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was interrupting. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so to help people in doing that, you have a technique that we would like to share with them that they could perhaps use to guide them in how to best accomplish that and move that forward, using perhaps the Tarot or another oracle or divination tool, because they can certainly listen to the technique and then decide how to use the tool they may work with in order to do it. Would you concur?
Yes, I would concur. The only sensible thing to do at this time when you're trying to get something off the back burner is to do a reading. And if this has been a project that's been a challenge for you to get going, I think it's time to cheat a little with the reading. I every once in a while, I think it's important to cheat with reading techniques and have an unambiguous finish to the spread. Sometimes there's a goal we're going after that we decide to be narrow about. It's not a way to go through life all the time, but what is it you were just had to accomplish? What would it look like if the thing you got done got done? And so in the way that some people pick a significator for a particular intention, for this spread, we'll do a 3-card spread just because that's easy. You're going to pick the significator for the outcome. You're going to decide the outcome. No open-ended ambiguousness, just pick. And then, for the heck of it, find the card that represents how you are right now at this time, not having, you know, wherever you're at. So the first and the third cards in the reading, you're going to pick consciously with the cards face up, going through them, to resemble how you perceive your situation. And then it's that middle card, what a lot of people call the bridge card between the two, that will express to you how to get it done. What is the practical step, or what is the step for right now to achieve that dream? And something I liked that you pointed out, Heisi, when we were talking about this technique before, was that that middle card might surprise you by being something you would just never, ever, ever, ever do. Like if the goal is to move up in your company, let's say, and the card that came up for you represented that you need to be deceitful and throw somebody under the bus, and it's just not who you are, maybe this just isn't the goal for you. That's a problematic example, I realize. But I'm just saying that maybe that doesn't mean whatever the middle card is the only thing you can do. But if you want to get the results that you have set forth in card number 3, by all means, really consider card number 2.
And you might have to just pay attention to that, because if it's a problematic card, maybe you have to re-examine the timeline that you're considering. And if you, you know, change that, then maybe a different card would come up if you then drew again. Or maybe you were going in a particular direction or thinking of doing it in a particular place, and maybe you have to reconsider those things and then see if that gives a more positive, I guess you could say, bridge card to indicate that this is something that can happen, or now here's how to get there. But if problematic cards keep coming up, you might have to accept that this isn't necessarily either the thing to do, or perhaps just isn't the thing at this time for you to be focusing on doing. So what you were saying, just to clarify the process, was
the first
card. So I just think of it, there's a card on the left, a card on the right, and then a card in the middle.
There's a big blank space in the middle, yeah.
Well, yeah, ultimately there will be a card.
Ultimately, there's, yeah, three card readings.
And so the card on the left is one you go through and actively choose face up from the deck, representing what it is you want to work on, or what it looks like right now, or where you're at right now with it. And then the one on the right, you do the same thing. You go through and actively choose from the deck face up a card that represents what you want the outcome to look like, what you want that to look like at, you know, the time frame you say. Like if I was thinking of the Saturn thing I just talked about, if I was saying, here's what it looks like right now with the card on the left, then by the end of the year or the fall, when I want to see the results coming about, here's what I want it to look like then. So that would be the card on the right.
For myself, just to pick a sort of a generic, or this reading is for all of you out there, I picked the Nine of Swords as the card on the left, as the maudlin kind of can't get out of bed, can't achieve, can't do it, can't rise to the occasion card. It's so hard, it's so difficult, kind of woe is me beginning. I thought I'd be dramatic.
Well, and that could also be a very good card to represent from the Saturn aspect, if we want to just tie it into this general theme, because it's like saying, I'm so stressed, I think it's never going to work because I've met with so many delays and so many complications over the past few months of trying to do this that it's probably just never going to happen. And that would be a very Nine of Swords mentality going on.
Exactly. And for the card on the far right, I pulled the King of Pentacles. And I chose that card because, for me, in a lot of ways, the King of Pentacles represents the self-made person, the person who has achieved their ambitions through hard work. Not that the middle card might represent hard work, but I just had to pick a card, and that's the one I picked. I wanted to be very successful at business and accomplished, and that's what felt good to me.
But I'll also say, because King of Pentacles is often associated as the card of Capricorn, and Capricorn is ruled by Saturn. And so as kind of a general reading, if it's, you know, we're kind of doing this, and this could be very applicable for everybody out there, it's kind of like saying, if or wherever you may be feeling distraught, anxious, stressed, created this mindset that something just isn't going to work because you're so worried or there's been so many delays, how do I go from that to feeling more successful and bringing about in a very real way the kind of goals or the kind of things that I have been envisioning or trying to do that I've been either worried about or felt I've been hit by delay after delay after delay that has caused me to start doubting whether it's ever going to happen? So I think that's kind of the storyline there.
That's right. I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. So the middle card you're going to draw is, how do I move from that Nine of Swords way of thinking and being to that King of Pentacles? I'm in control, I'm in charge, I make things happen, and I'm successful at manifesting what I want.
And you know, it's so funny. I pulled a card, and it's the Seven of Cups. From the Rider-Waite. And I was like, technique doesn't work. No. And so, given sort of, this is just a generic reading out there, the interpretation of that makes the most sense to me at this time is that from all the myriad choices that your imagination can concoct, pick the one aspect of this project that you can really take into yourself and make happen at this time. Just that one, not the whole thing. Don't take on, you know, as they say, some things are bigger than the sky. So just choose the closest cup, you know, the castle. Just choose the closest item, because often Seven of Cups cards show the person sort of at a loss when faced with myriad options. I also like that in a previous podcast, I think it represented the power of our imagination. But at this time, the power of your imagination is not the greatest tool to take to hand and by, you know, make a choice. But what would your thoughts on the Seven of Cups be in that middle card?
Well, I might challenge a little bit what you said at the end there about imagination, because when we get into that Nine of Swords way of thinking, we're giving up, we're only creating what-if scenarios about how everything's going to go wrong and nothing's ever going to happen. Nine of Swords for me can become self-sabotage, so we start creating a reality to prove that everything is bad. And Seven of Cups is kind of reminding us to remember, come back to imagination, come back to dreaming and hoping and believing in the possibility again. Because King of Pentacles doesn't give up because they have a delay or they have an obstacle or a challenge to what they're trying to do. And then they determine, oh, well, if I try anything, it's never going to happen. I'm sure if I do this, it's going to go wrong. Or if I do this, it's going to go wrong. They can come back to that Seven of Cups and remember that, no, it's still a possibility, but maybe this cup that I pulled from over here wasn't quite the right one. So I still have other cups to choose from, and I'm going to pull one of those and see where that takes me rather than giving up altogether.
I see what you're saying there, and it's like telling that person in the Nine of Cups, like, oh, dear heart, like, the world is full of possibilities. And
right. And in some ways, it's saying, you know, what I was saying is similar to what you were saying, because it is focusing on one cup, but don't think that just because that cup doesn't bring you what you want or what you are anticipating, that you have to give up, versus there's still six other cups. So choose another cup and focus on that one and see where that takes you. Because that might open up a possibility, or at least move it forward one or two steps, and then something else will be needed. But at least it's continuing to move forward, and we haven't given up on it.
Yeah, so failure is a stepping stone here to that ultimate success.
Right. And I would look at the number seven, because for me, seven, one of the aspects of seven, well, two things I would say, is take a step back and look at the big picture to determine, am I still going in the direction I want to? And two, seven is a number of commitment. And so it may also say that part of the bridge is we have to commit or recommit to what it is we want to do rather than getting stuck or giving up.
Yes. And one thing to point out with this technique is that even though you're only pulling one card, so it would be very easy to get caught up in the idea that you're really doing a one-card reading, it's important to do what you've been doing is making the connections between the Seven and the Nine of Swords and the Seven of Cups and the King of Pentacles. It's still a spread that you're reading the whole spread and seeing that those connections. It's just that that's the one card that is selected.
Just because a person has chosen two of the cards consciously doesn't mean you don't treat it like a one-card reading. It's still a three-card spread and a three-card reading. So I think that that's a very good point to make.
And an advanced reader might then, like, get excited and try to put extra layers on this. Maybe they want to pull an oracle card for the center, or maybe clarifying cards, or asking questions about whether their goal is correct, or from other standpoint about where their start-off point is correct. That's not this spread. That's not this technique. Stop.
Right. Stop. Although I would perhaps do a quintessence. I always like to do quintessence. And because here you could do that. Quintessence is just where you add up all of the numbers of all of the cards in the spread to see what major arcana card is kind of the overriding theme or lesson or whatever.
Fine.
You know, and so here it would be the Tower, because you'd have 7 and 9, which is 16.
Ooh.
And in some ways the Tower could say that, you know, we've got to blow the lid off of this way of thinking that is self-sabotaging our ability to actually move forward to making this happen, which is like blowing the blinders off because we're only seeing it one way. And Seven of Cups asks us to see many possibilities. But also I think the Tower card can say something may happen very quickly or there may be a sudden aha moment. And so if we can engage that Seven of Cups or whatever that card might have been, but here the Seven of Cups, then it may actually suddenly happen or suddenly lurch forward. It's kind of like trying to start the car and all of a sudden it starts and you go, huh, and it lurches forward. There may be that aspect that happens because of that quintessence card. So I certainly wouldn't give up with the Seven of Cups coming up.
Yeah. Excellent. So that's
well, thank
technique.
You for,
try it out.
Thank
kids.
You for that technique. Yes, we would encourage people. And if you do try it out and you'd like to share how it worked for you, feel free to come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/theamethystorical and post your what you did or how it turned out for you or other thoughts or suggestions you had about that technique, because we would love to hear that, as well as anybody else that is looking at the page would also benefit from seeing how it's been put to use in other people's experiences. So I would certainly encourage that. So I just want to remind people that if you'd like a reading during the show a little bit later, then you can Skype in from the show page or you can call 646-716-5510 and we would be more than happy to have a little chat with you and see what the cards might have to say for whatever it is that you're asking about or needing guidance on. Hopefully I can speak for both of us there, Charlie. And coming up next, what do you think? Shall we give them the star of the show this month?
Yeah, stop listening to us and start listening to us and Rachel.
That's right. So we're very excited because coming up in just a minute is our conversation with Rachel Pollack. So hopefully you will be as intrigued, interested, excited, and dazzled by it as we were. We will admit that we had to pre-record the interview with her, so there you go. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't lessen the enjoyment of it in the least. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Rachel Pollack.
Save the date. Mark your calendar. Join John Carosella for The First Agreement, Adam and the Power of the Runes at East West Bookstore in Mountain View on Thursday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Why be impeccable with our words? What unseen powers reside within them? Where does the power of symbol come from, and how does it affect us? How do we bring this power into our awareness and begin to consciously harness it? Join compassionate adventure guide John Carosella on a journey into the subtle sorcery and hidden transformational powers of words and symbols at East West Bookstore in Mountain View, California, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Visit www.eastwest.com/events for details.
Couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep when love came and told me I shouldn't sleep.
Rachel Pollack is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the modern interpretation of tarot. She is also a poet, an award-winning novelist, and a tarot card and comic book artist. She has published 12 books on the tarot, including 78 Degrees of Wisdom, considered by many to be a modern classic and the Bible of tarot reading. Its marriage of common sense, wide-ranging knowledge, and esoteric awareness have inspired many tens of thousands of readers worldwide to a deeper knowledge of the tarot. Let's welcome Rachel Pollack to this episode of The Amethyst Oracle.
Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered, am I?
So welcome to the show, Rachel. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're very excited to have you here. And I think we have some very rich topics and questions to be discussing today. So we look forward to hearing where you're going to take us in this conversation. You know, one of the things that prompted Charlie and I to want to ask you to be on the show is we were at PantheaCon in San Jose in February, and you gave a presentation there about the gods and goddesses in the Tarot. And we were wondering if you could maybe tell us what the genesis of starting to look at the Tarot in that way was and what you've started to uncover as you've gone through that.
Well, it's always been an interest of mine. I've been interested in mythology all my life, you know, and in terms of also ritual and magic and things like that. And then, you know, it's always interesting, what is the backdrop behind the cards and the symbolism? Because there's one thing, you know, there's all these different levels of tarot cards, and one of the things that makes them so fascinating. And for many people, if they wish to go, you know, deeper into the cards beyond simply their immediate meanings and their divinatory meanings, they look to systems of thought, such as Kabbalah, for instance, and Pythagorean ideas, and, you know, Hermetic. This is like a very, very complicated. And many of those things use, you know, the gods and goddesses. But in my mind, I tend to think in terms of story more than I tend to think in terms of systems. So to me, it's, you know, less important what correspondences something connects to astrologically and, you know, angels and demons and so on and so on and so on, as it is to find stories in the pictures. To me, that's what makes them so exciting. And that's one reason why I love the writer death so much, because they're like moments in the story. So pretty early on, I became interested in the idea of, you know, what gods and goddesses are represented in the tarot. And some of them are quite specific. I mean, I'm talking about the writer death primarily that now. And some of them, you know, are really clear. So, for example, the Empress card. She has on her shield, which is heart-shaped, the symbol for the planet Venus, also for the goddess Venus, as well as being the symbol for woman. And so that's a clear reference to the goddess of love, you know, Venus Aphrodite. And then around her grows wheat, which is a symbol of the goddess Demeter, the mother goddess of growing things. So, you know, that's pretty specific. See, we can see that. And then on the fortune card, there's, you know, Egyptian deities. So clearly Waite and Smith had in mind some kinds of, you know, mythological figures.
Mm-hmm.
And Hermes is present in the very fact that the magician is said to be, you know, practicing Hermetic tradition. Hermes, the god of magic and wisdom. And so certain things are quite clear. There's, of course, angels from the Christian tradition. But when I started to see, you know, other things were hinted at. So the high priestess, for instance, you know, what is she a high priestess of? It's an interesting question. Well, she's dressed as Isis, partly. She wears the triple moon crown of Hathor, which then became associated with Isis, you know. She has a curtain behind her, as in the veil of Isis. So clearly she represents Isis. Then she has pomegranates behind her, and pomegranates are connected to the goddess Persephone, who eats pomegranates in the land of the dead, and so can only come back for part of the year. She cycles between the dead and the living.
Mm-hmm.
Pomegranates also represent the Kabbalah tradition. And the reason for that is that we learn that paradise is a garden or an orchard of pomegranates. That was the image they had for paradise. Part is really new, orchard of pomegranates. So we're starting to see all kinds of, you know, clues at different figures. Zeus is associated with the emperor simply because, you know, the emperor is the, you know, the divine father and so on. And then one of the big meaningful things for me was when I was in Greece years ago and celebrating the Eleusinian mysteries, which are connected to Persephone and Demeter. And at the end of the mysteries, they poured water out from two vessels into cracks in the earth. And so I found my water vessels were just mineral water bottles. And the cracks in the earth I found were a cave on one side of me and steep, like an abyss off a cliff on the other side. So I poured the water out into it, and I realized that's the star card. coming after the devil in the tower, she returns from the dead, basically, and is pouring the waters of life out of her gourd. So to me, the star card became Persephone. So that's an example of, I doubt very much that Waite had in mind that the star card would secretly represent Persephone. But it really works, because also, the Hierophant card, what does the word Hierophant mean? The Hierophant was a person who officiated at the mysteries. Now, Waite had in mind the tradition of mysteries that began in what's called the Alexandrian period, a period before the birth of Christ and so on. And those were like sort of secret groups. The secret societies, like the Golden Dawn, came out of these mystery cults, And they were kind of intellectual, they were kind of spiritual, they were very elitist. You had to, be invited to join and so on. But actually, the original Hierophant was the person who officiated at the mysteries in Eleusis. They were the mysteries of Persephone. And those were rituals that were open to anybody who could speak Greek, and speak Greek was not a murderer. Fascinating regulations,
It's not a high bar to clear.
They were held every 5 years for thousands of years, and they attracted as many as 5,000 people. It's an incredible story. And so the word Hierophant, therefore, connects us to the mysteries. So these are the ways in which you can start threading your way to just discover, these divine figures. So what do you do with that? Well, you start seeing how the story underlies the stories of people's readings. So I've seen many readings in which the star card appears, and it's clearly relevant to, retell quickly the story of Persephone, because women, these are for women mostly, but men too, who have had, been through a horrible experience, who perhaps were abused, perhaps were, very oppressed in some way. And so the whole idea of liberation, of coming back from that, but also having power to help others, Another great secret backdrop to the tarot cards is Rapunzel. The big clue there is that when the evil sorceress, Frau Gothel, her name is, when she, finds out that Rapunzel is secretly sleeping with the prince, she sort of basically throws them out of a tower with no door, only a window. And that's the image on the tower card. A man and a woman, being flung out of a window from a tower with no door to crash below. And then there's other things, like, once again, the star card comes in because the prince is blinded. And when he finds Rapunzel again, she weeps onto his eyes and they heal. And that's, again, the waters of the star card, which are waters of healing. There's various other things connected to Rapunzel very sharply in the tarot card. So these are not things that were intended, but they're meaningful, I tend to look at the Greek tradition because and the Hebrew, because those are the ones that interest me the most. But certainly, many people, see the fool as Taliesin, who's sort of reborn as a magical wise child. And so there's that kind of connection. Other people, I know, because Robin Wood has Taliesin with a harp in the chariot card, or maybe Orpheus. So many people have looked at this and seen this, there are gods and goddesses, tarots, where they really are very, very specific about this. But to me, it's more important, to find the stories and see how they connect to people's lives. So that's really what that's about, the ritual and magic as well.
And I know you did a reading or a spread in your book, Soul Forest, that kind of like once you've identified the deity in that card, you like pulling up more cards to find out like what you what they want from you you can grow in order to be with them. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. For many of us, gods and goddesses are not just imaginative creations. They're actually real. They're people you can meet. And so asking what they want from us is a very meaningful thing to ask. But even if you just see it as a imaginative construction, it's so important to say, what does this want from me?
Do you think that...
What does it want from me?
When you mentioned how...
how do we work together? Questions like that, which you might ask about someone you'd met that was, maybe going to enter into a partnership with you in some way. or a relationship of some kind. Same kind of questions.
When you mentioned that some decks, you know, get very specific in terms of like the pantheon that they're representing or, you know, that kind of thing, do you think that that dilutes or takes away from some of those layers that you're able to kind of see in, say, something like the Waite-Smith deck? Because there it's not quite so specific, so it can, because I kind of think of the tarot as doorways to the gods, and therefore it gives you a doorway to access whatever god or goddess that may then lead you to, rather than being so specific you get a little stuck.
I think that's probably true, yes, yeah. You know, I guess if you're really, you know, very part of a tradition, then seeing your tradition represented is powerful, you know. And
right.
Someone once asked me, you know, when I was giving a lecture, this person said that a friend of his was making a tarot deck. What was the single most important piece of advice I could give? And without any thought at all, my immediate answer was to not be specific.
Mm.
And then I realized, mm-hmm. when I thought about that, where that came from, that one of the things about the Rider deck is the people often have, like, blank expressions.
Mm-hmm.
And situations are ambiguous. And as a result, you could read into it many, many things. Where some later decks that model themselves as Rider deck and think they're, you know, taking it to a next level, what they do is they decide what a certain card means and they illustrate that.
Mm, right. Right.
You know? And so all those other things become lost. All the other possibilities that someone else might see become lost. And it's the same with gods and goddesses. I mean, you know, if you specifically make a, you know, I'll say the hermit Ceridwen, you know, the old crone figure of Celtic myth. All the other solitary, old, wise figures are lost. On the other hand, like I said, you know, if Ceridwen is extremely important to you, then it's really valuable to have a deck that has Ceridwen as a figure. So
right.
It's a trade-off, you know.
And in investigating or delving into the mysteries of, like, the Waite-Smith deck to find those connections to the gods and goddesses, what's the most surprising thing or things that you've discovered or the most surprising mystery that has been revealed to you as you've been doing that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess generally the idea, you know, that you just can discover so much. And that it doesn't matter if it was intended there consciously or if it kind of slipped in under the surface. I feel like somebody's, you know, some of these divine beings basically saw the Rider deck and saw their chance to, you know, to appear in the world. They kind
everybody
of,
in.
They kind of slipped in through Pamela Smith's spontaneous imagery, you know. Or even Waite's choice of symbols somehow, you know.
It's true. Some, like, you know, I don't know, like certain printings of the deck will have some little curly Q line, and then you can find pages and pages and pages of interpretations about what the line actually means, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So besides deities, I know that you've worked with the Rider deck to look at sort of gender and even transgender issues. And since we're the, I don't mean issues, I don't know, discoveries, since we're the queer divination, or divination with a queer twist, could you talk a little bit about what you've discovered there? Because I don't think many people have gotten to talk about that gender dynamic in tarot.
Well, first of all, I haven't particularly worked on a kind of queer divination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't tend to model divinations to one group or another.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm interested in is just seeing what you might call queer stories in the tarot. And first of all, the Rider deck again. This is so much the Rider deck, these kinds of things is what I know best. My own deck, to some extent, even less so, because the Rider deck has that mysterious ambiguity so much. One of the ways it has it is that a great many of the figures are androgynous.
Mm-hmm.
People have often commented how, like, you know, the magician has a very feminine face despite him being meant to represent, you know, the masculine principle. Some of the knights may have actually been modeled upon women actors of that period who were doing male roles, like, you know, sort of playing Hamlet or something, like, you know, Sarah Bernhardt did, and so on. So there's a certain, you know, ambiguity in general in the way the tarot figures look. Some not, obviously the emperor is extremely masculine and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then other cards, like some of the queens, for instance, look very masculine.
Yeah, the
queen. The way they fit, their expressions, you know.
Yeah.
And some of the knights are very feminine. So this in the pages, of course, are, you know, often very feminine, like the Page of Cups is, you know, very girlish. So there's that issue right there, you know, who are, you know, the figures that you can right away be moving, you know, into sort of, you know, crossing gender barriers and roles and stuff like that through the figures of some of the characters. But then there's also this interesting thing that happens in the writer deck, Major Arcana, which is something I kind of discovered by accident in an odd way, which is that I had always thought that one of the big symbolic things that goes on in the deck is the idea of the masculine's on the right and the feminine's on the left. And it kind of begins in the High Priestess, the light pillar on the right, the dark pillar on the left, because light's associated with yang and dark with yin and so on. And then you have cards like, the lover's card is the main example. Mm-hmm. It was the man's on the right and the woman's on the left, you know. And in the class one time, I said how this continues all the way to the very end, in which we see the judgment card, in which once again the man's on the right and the woman's on the left, I took it out and it's the opposite. And I was kind of stunned. I'd never noticed that. They switch positions, you know. And then I started thinking, well, when does this happen? You know, how does this change? And I discovered it's in the Tower card. The last card that represents the, you know, traditional idea of masculine right, feminine left, is the Devil. And the Devil is like a parody of the lovers. So it's like people, like, someone level has taken their symbolism to the point to which it becomes kind of atrophied. It becomes rigid and holds people prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Tower card is like this, you know, violent, extreme overthrow of that. And suddenly, you know, the feminine figure is on the right and the masculine is on the left. That which was seen as the proper gender positions is overthrown. You know? And then we have the star who's released and so on. And then the judgment card, there they are, you know, the woman's on the right, the man's on the left, and there's the child between with the angel above, and so on. So I was thinking about that, and I was talking with someone about issues of gender and transsexuality, and saying how, you know, for many people, accepting their transgender reality is this huge shock. And it simply overthrows their lives. And it's like a revelation. And it's odd how often that happens. I mean, probably less so now because the world is much more open to experimentation. But in the old days, and you have to remember I'm ancient, in the old days, you know, you really couldn't experiment with these ideas, and so people resisted a lot. They didn't know what was wrong with them, you know. I remember one story that this writer named Ricky and Wilson's told, which is a wonderful story, is that her life was a mess, and she was really messed up, and she was, you know, living as a man, not understanding what was wrong, why she, everything was so bad. And she decided to take a shower to try to, like, loosen up. And in the shower, she said, okay, I got to think to myself, what's the worst thing this could all be about? All these strange feelings and desires I have, you know, things. What's the worst possible thing it could be? And then, you know, Ricky came out of the shower and went up to a girlfriend and said, I'm a woman. And the girlfriend said, at that time you figured that out. It's a really wonderful story. And other people said it was like a glass wall shattering, you know?
Yeah, that was a tower.
Yeah. A trans man I know, you know, tells this great story of, you know, for years having this kind of awful dream of looking in a mirror and not seeing anything. There's no reflection, you know. I would wake up very, very frightened. One of the old-fashioned, you know, mirrors on a stand that are two-sided, you know, and you can flip them. And then after, like, you know, suddenly deciding that he kind of, you know, really had to accept that he was not really a butch lesbian, he was really, you know, a transgendered man, had the dream. And this time there was a voice that turned the mirror around, and now there was a man's face in the mirror. And he said that that was, like, equally terrifying, but now because he understood and knew what he had to do, you know, rather than being confused. So the Tower is kind of, you know, that kind of experience. And the Devil is the state that people can be in before they obtrude themselves.
Wow.
You know, everything becomes feeling trapped. They feel kind of locked in. They're not where they belong. They, you know, may be trying to be in relationships and it's not honest and so on and so on. And then the tower is that state of revelation, you know? And then the star is that feeling of relief and joy. Then the moon after the star is like, you know, this is a difficult passage. It's unknown. It's weird.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people might be horrified. As I said, these days it's a lot better. You know, people are, they know about it. They understand it a bit. They're more open to it, you know. But still, it's, you know, it's a journey you have to make yourself, even if you have supportive people around you. And if there are examples of people who've done it before you, it's a strange passage. But then once you make it, you're in the sun and you're joyous and it's like being reborn, you know? And then we have the new version of your reality in the awakening card. And then of course the world card is famously hermaphroditic.
Yeah, I was going to say it's like the divine androgyne.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting because one thing that I often think about is how, there between the fool and the world. So the fool is a very androgynous young person said to be a boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But with a very feminine appearance. The world card is very specifically a woman, but it's said to be an hermaphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look between an androgyne and a hermaphrodite, to me, the androgynous state is when all things are possible, whereas the hermaphrodite is when all things are realized.
Oh, I love
so
that.
So that's part of the process of the major arcana, to realize your possibilities.
So in the world card, she's both fully male and fully experiencing male and fully experiencing being female.
Yeah.
Whereas
even though it tends to be in a feminine imagery. Of course, some older images, you know, the source of the world card may very well be the images of Christ resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just, you know, questions of how it got to be a female figure are a little confusing. It's unknown. Some people say, it's just, you know, people who card printers looked at a picture, didn't realize it was supposed to be a man, and saw these sort of dots and thought they were breasts, so they made him a woman. Who knows? Could be a super goddess movement.
So I was just looking at the tower card as you were talking about it. And
yeah.
this may get into those things like Charlie was talking about where it's, you know, writing volumes on a curlicue of a line. But
yeah.
I for the first time I noticed that the yodes that are coming out from the tower,
mm-hmm.
on the man's side, the yodes surround the man, but on the mm-hmm. woman's side, the yodes are actually still up in the sky, and she's very separated
that, yeah.
from the yodes. So right now, what does that mean? What does it mean, Rachel? What does it mean?
Also, they're above the clouds and below the clouds.
Right.
You know? So, but I'm not sure. It's interesting. There's also 10 on the woman's side and 12 on the man's side, so, you know, making 22.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe, you know, there's an idea that the man is more in the midst of the, you know, divine consciousness and the woman still has to come. I'm not sure.
Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just thought it was a curiosity
as
I was looking at
that. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Just very quickly, I know that coming up in the next week or so, well, actually, probably you'll be starting when we are airing the show. You're going to be at the Omega Institute with Mary Greer, and you've been doing this, I think, for like 25 years, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I've been doing with her. She did it a year or two before me.
Ah, and so what's your theme this year, and can you explain a little bit about what you do at the Omega Institute?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a 5-day residential thing. And so people live there, you know, you live and breathe tarot for 5 days. It's a really wonderful group of people. I've never seen it when it works in a great community. And first of all, Mary and I, you know, we really have that very consciously in mind to foster community and to foster, like, you know, people being together rather than teacher-student or isolation, you know. So, for instance, we always invite anyone who wishes to join us for meals. A lot of other teachers at Omega, you know, maybe by themselves in the faculty dining room. And, you know, Mary saw this before I was even there, always, you know, inviting the class to join us and then hanging out afterwards in the cafe. So there's a real sense of, you know, being with your tribe of tarot people, which is great. And then, you know, it's very much experiential. It's very much, you know, because people are there to to learn it for themselves. So we guide people a lot. We definitely have exercises, but there's an awful lot of people doing it for themselves. And this year, the theme is about balancing interactive readings with intuitive readings. What do you mean by that? Are interactive readings are readings where, like, you know, the clairvoyant does a lot of the interpretation. So we get the magician card, and I say to you, well, you know, how would you describe this picture? What's going on here? Who is this person? You know, I'm actually, you know, tell me a story about him. You know, tell me about magic or something like that. So you're, like, getting to what it means to you, you know? Intuitive readings are readings in which the reader explains things to the person. The magician comes up and says, this is time for you to have a creative breakthrough. You know, you've been working on something, and you feel like you're not there yet, and now it's suddenly it's going to start to flow. You just have to open yourself up to it, things like that, you know? Or, more specifically, you know, this means you're going to sell a house, you know, for your predictions. So a lot of people, you know, want one or the other, or they're confused. But I said, we're going to just, you know, experiment. We always learn a lot of the makeup. Experiment with, you know, bridging those two kinds of styles.
Yeah,
magic involved and some intuitive stuff and some, you know, psychological searching.
Yeah, I've attended that before, and what you were saying, it's really kind of a amazing experience to just be immersed in tarot with no outside distractions or anything over the course of a week, because you really, I think, go into and discover a lot more about what the tarot has to say to you, as well as how you can work with it by not it just being, you know, a quick 15, 20 minute interaction with the cards for a reading versus that immersion process. As we start to think about what you were talking about with the Omega Institute in terms of being readers and our relationship with the cards and all of that, what would you see is the role of the tarot reader in today's world? I was listening to a podcast recently, and they were talking about it's focused on hoodoo and root workers. And they were talking about what's the role of the hoodoo or the root worker in the community today compared to what it was in the past. And so I'm curious how you might see what the role of the tarot reader is today, maybe in contrast to what it was in the past, or just how you've seen it develop.
It's always a very difficult question, because I feel like it involves kind of predictive things that are really hard to predict, big social movements, you know? It's hard to know. I mean, I don't think tarot and society has changed really all that much. I think to go, people have access to a lot more tools. You know, the internet, you know, programmed readings and so on. But I'm not sure that the position of tarot in the world has changed that much in the last, you know, 20 years or so. There's always, you know, people who are interested in it, always people who are frightened of it, superstitious. You know, as the clients I get seem to be a little more open to the idea that it's not going to do magic, you know, psychic fortune-telling stuff that'll illuminate things more. But I'm not sure, like, you know, what would actually dramatically change the tarot-related relationship in society. One thing that comes to mind is if there's, like, you know, some shift in science that makes the idea of, you know, predictive devices meaningful in the scientific framework. That might, you know, have a big difference in order to bring this kind of thing back into, you know, the center of our culture. I can take a card from the Shining Tribe tarot and we'll see what it says. Ah, it's the devil. How funny.
it's true.
The devil in the Shining Tribe tarot is, you know, first of all, the Shining Tribe tarot is a sense of humor. So, of course, it's playing with that, you know, image that, you know, a lot of people have that the tarot is the work of the devil. But also, in the Shining Tribe, the devil is kind of being stuck in layers. It's layers that normally surround the devil and squeezing him. So the idea is somehow to step out of the layers, not stay, you know, in traditional positions. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the tarot world takes a kind of bold step into the mainstream. I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, and also I think, you know, oftentimes the, like, with the layers, the devil card is often associated with the shadow. And it may be that the role of the tarot reader in today's world is to assist people in exploring and working on those shadow aspects, because we often are very neglectful of those things with so much distraction in our world, or we're kind of told not to go there. As well as in the world in general, there seems to be a much more prevalent shadow side coming out over the past few years. And maybe the role of the tarot reader is to help individuals find a way to navigate through the darkness of those shadows and to stay focused on the light and use tarot as a way of moving towards that rather than getting lost in that darkness.
Mm. And also, of course, it could be a less optimistic mode. You could be saying that, you know, it's not a joke to point out the devil connection that people have in their minds, because maybe you will, you know, end up being subject to a kind of, you know, right-wing religious backlash.
Right.
Mm. I hate to think so, but, you know, it's always possible.
Why not?
Yeah. And I think we've also seen over the past few years a shift from the tarot being very psychological based, because it seems over maybe since like the 70s, 80s that it really started moving much more towards a more psychological way of using and interpreting the tarot. And I think maybe even the renaissance of kind of the Lenormand coming back speaks to that, going to a more
cut and dry. The whole Lenormand thing is people feel like they lost fortune telling and they want it back. People I know who just, you know, well, the tarot always has these very great layers and depths and subtlety. Lenormand is straight out divination.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and really happy to be able to do that. Happy to have that available to them. It's kind of interesting.
And you've probably seen interesting trends kind of come and go with the tarot in, because you've been working with the tarot, I think, since like the late 60s. That correct?
1970. Yeah.
1970.
Early 1970, basically.
And so putting on your diviner's predictive hat, where would you envision seeing what's happening right now and kind of what you've seen trends be over the past 30 or 40 years? Where would you see the tarot? How would you see it evolving, or where do you maybe see it going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I've said a lot that I feel that, you know, in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, a whole bunch of us working independently, but still nonetheless, kind of came together to do what I call rescue the tarot from fortune telling. To open up the tarot to something wider and deeper, which was then our tool was psychology. It was a psychological age. Everyone was in therapy, you know? I mean that in a very literal sense. You know, people all, it wasn't because they all were messed up. They all thought therapy was how you improve as a person, you know? Anyway, so, you know, the tarot became psychological in a number of books and teachings and stuff. And now I said, you know, last year I've been talking about how we have to rescue the tarot from psychology. You know?
And well,
I would hope that it's not just going back to fortune telling, because it seems to me you spiral upwards rather than step backwards, you know? But certainly I think it needs to reincorporate, you know, certainly a kind of fortune telling. Quality, as you know, shouldn't be neglected in the tarot.
I think you specifically have been also working on kind of, not just so you really helped free tarot from fortune telling, but you also took it even further. I think it was like a Llewellyn Reader a few years ago, where you were sort of you wrote, you're wondering like if we had lost the mystical experience of tarot, not just the fortune telling aspect of it, but like the mystical experience. And I think that's about the time that wisdom you created. Or birthed wisdom reading. And I think that has been really powerful for people who, you know, like the want to take that psychological approach, but a little bit further, a little bit more, a little more cosmic, a little more mythical. So well done, you.
Yeah, thank you. You went to readings when you asked the tarot questions, like what is the role of tarot in the world today? Rather than like what's going to happen to me next week, you know?
Well, and perhaps, perhaps each of us could do a quick wisdom reading around the question we just asked as well. And we'll just see what comes up in terms of where is the tarot evolving in the next 5 to 10 years, and we can just pull a card and see
You actually already cut the deck for that, like at the Ace of Trees, the Ace of Wands. The Ace of Trees shows a fetus in a kind of golden amniotic fluid, not inside a womb, but inside it, like a hill. And then the umbilical cord reaches out past the amniotic fluid to become the tree of life, so that the cosmos is feeding the baby. And what that means is that, you know, something is about to be born, something new. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's something that we can necessarily say exactly what it is, but definitely some major, you know, new step. So that's, you know, so the Tarot is more, more excited than I am about, you know, about some major change happening. It's kind of interesting.
And I pulled a card as well, and I think it really ties into that because I got the Four of Swords reversed.
Okay,
so
yeah.
There's that sense of, A, it's probably coming fairly quickly, that maybe it's been on hold or been waiting, but it's not going to be waiting much longer.
Yeah.
And there is that sense of kind of waking up or coming back life or consciousness, which is very much that Ace of Wands as well. And when you speak of the umbilical cord, it's kind of like the rebirth of this something new awakening or coming into being.
Mm. The one that just sort of fell out, that wasn't the one I pulled, was the Knight of Cups, which just kind of echoes like it's Tarot's about to go on a journey, a romantic journey. But what it, from the Rider-Waite, it was the Nine of Pentacles. So the idea that I think it's going to be deeply, powerfully personal for people, and will help their sort of their flowering, their coming into themselves in kind of a tremendous, dramatic way.
I mean, people have to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say Knight of Pentacles is very disciplined and hardworking to get to that point where she has that wonderful pentacle push.
Yeah. And isn't the Knight of Cups often seen as like going after the Holy Grail?
Well, you seem to have it because, you know, the cup is the grail.
Right. Well, I was thinking with this something new awakening or being born that maybe it's time for a new grail for the Tarot and those who work with the Tarot to be going after rather than just staying complacent in the old grail that it's kind of reached.
Let me take one more card and we'll see what it is that Tarot needs to go after.
Ooh. Oh. So for me, again, I think it's that sense of humor that the Tarot has because I had the Four of Swords reversed and then the next card came up is the Hanged Man reversed.
So
it seems to reemphasize there's no more waiting. There's no more hanging around for something to happen. It's time to start the doing.
I would also say it means like, you know, getting in touch with the wider society. Being less cut off and elitist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finding ways to reach, you know, society on their own terms rather than being upside down from everyone else.
Right, and bringing it out from underneath the surface to something more visible.
Yeah. So before we close this down, Rachel, is there any particular projects coming up that people should know about in the world of tarot and divination?
I think the most exciting thing is that Robert Place, who created the Alchemical Tarot and Tarot of the Seven Mysteries, and working together with me to create a Lunar Mandek. Oh. And the Lunar Mandek we're doing has all the traditional pictures, but often has, other currents in it. Sometimes subtle things, sometimes things a little bit more strong, you know, things that are kind of hopefully, you know, really fascinating to people. So it would be possible to use these, you know, the book I'm doing emphasizes, you know, using them in a very traditional Lunar Mind kind of way, but also the option to go to some of these deeper, and not even symbolic, but more like journey levels, more like magical stories, you know?
So is this the Oracle of the Burning Serpent?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, excellent. I was looking at those
at the moment,
cards.
We're calling it a Lunar Mind of the Soul.
I love it. Okay, so when I
heard... Bob came up with it. It was a nice expression.
I heard you were doing a little mantra, and I'm like, wait a minute. Like, Rachel, is it going to be the shamanic, Kabbalistic Lenormand that's going to, like, open new worlds, or what is
it? Well, to some extent,
yeah.
Definitely not Kabbalistic. One of the things we're definitely not doing is having any kind of, like, you know, underlying system of correspondences or rules.
I like it. And this is something that's being crowdsourced. So is it going to be through like a Indiegogo or a Kickstarter campaign?
Yeah. Bob has more experience with this, so I'm going to definitely let Bob take the lead on how to set that up. But not yet, because we want to make sure we're at a point where we really, you know, have things to show to people.
Okay.
We're hoping that's going to happen by the end of the summer. That's our goal.
Well, thank you very much, Rachel, for being willing to join us today. And we will look forward to the end of the summer with the announcement of the Lenormand project.
Yeah, it might be announced sooner than that, but we're hoping to actually have it ready for the end of the summer. We'll see.
Very
cool. Definitely in process, and we're definitely making great progress. Bob's pictures are just amazing, and I'm really enjoying exploring them, you know, in the book.
Right on.
So hopefully maybe we will be able to look forward to having your wisdom and experience on the show again sometime in the future.
Sure, that would be great. Thank you.
And I will just remind people that Rachel also makes amazing jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, do you do things other than necklaces, or it is always necklaces?
So far it's been necklaces. I've tried earrings. I wasn't terribly pleased with the results. So I'm just staying with necklaces.
Well, so I would encourage people to really check those out. Can they do that through your website at rachelpollack.com?
Or do you have those? And get the photography more developed. They can write to me, rachel@rachelpollack.com, and I could tell them about it and maybe have some pictures to show them.
All right. But your website, rachelpollack.com, will also always have information about events and things that you're appearing at, things you're working on, as well as how to contact
you. Sometimes
it
gets a bit out of date. I have to update it, but usually it has the information.
Or even if they want a reading, if they want a reading from you, they can also go there to contact you that way.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah.
All right. And it's rachelpollack, PollackCK.com.
Yes, that's right.
For people listening. Well, thank you very, very much.
And thank you too.
Have an amazing summer and a great conference in Australia.
Thank you.
Burned a lot, but learned a lot. And now you are broke, so you earned a lot. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered. No more.
At Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest, or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable change makers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE. Helping you find and shine your inner light.
By Euripides. Oh, for long nights of worship gay, with the pale gleam of dancing feet, with head tossed high to the dewy air, pleasure mysterious and sweet. Oh, for the joy of a fawn at play in the fragrant meadows, green delight, who has leaped out free from the woven snare, away from the terror of chase and flight, and the huntsman's shout and the straining pack, and skims the sand by the river's brim, with the speed of wind in each long limb, to the blessed lonely forest where the soil's unmarked by human track, and leaves hang thick and the shades are dim. From the Bacchae by Euripides.
Well, thank you for that lovely reading, Charlie.
But no. Why was I reading it?
Well,
that should be explained at some level.
I'm going to say that it's because, at least for Americans, July is a month that's associated with freedom and independence, because we have our 4th of July celebration. I suppose the French have it a bit too, because they have their 14th of July, Bastille Day.
Oh, that's
yes. And what you have just read was a lovely poetic vision of freedom. Mm. And that just leaping through the world and going through life unencumbered, leaping when and where somebody might want to. And I think that's what we might want to think about and encourage in people this month, because this is our regular segment, Living the Queer Life, where we like to pull from whatever oracle or oracles we so desire and say, how can we live a more full and, here I would say, free life in the coming month? How can we feel greater freedom to simply be ourselves in our life and in the world? And what you just wrote would be on what you just wrote, what you just read. Wow.
In a past life.
Yeah. You were Euripides. But, you know, what you just read really kind of illustrates that and perhaps can plant that seed for us to think about when we're feeling stuck or limited or fearful of being ourselves and say, let us just be a fawn. Like that fawn, let me just take the leap and let me just go here or wherever it is that seems right in this moment, rather than over planning or getting too caught up in what other people are telling us we should be or how we should do something. So it's our little theme.
And the passage was chosen as an act of bibliomancy by opening The Essential Gay Mystics, edited by Andrew Harvey, to a passage. And it just so happened, you mentioned a passage about freedom, and I hoped for the best, and Euripides came through. So, you know, bibliomancy is a fun technique if you ever just need some words of inspiration.
I agree. And I think it's a very underutilized and undervalued form of divination or oracular work. So I would encourage more people to give it a try.
Right on.
And then as a follow-up to doing the bibliomancy, you also then pulled a card from, do you want to say what the deck was?
Oh, well, inspired by it being Euripides, I happen to have at hand, because I have a billion oracles here, the mythic oracle. So during your song, knowing that I was going to be reading Euripides, I pulled a card from the mythic oracle, which are Greek deities. And I happened to get Heracles. I think most people know the Roman name better, which is Hercules. And Heracles in this deck is depicted with scenes from the labors of Heracles, notably the Nemean lion, the golden apple of the Hesperides, and the hind behind him, the hind being the deer that he had to pursue for a year. And I thought that was fantastic that the hind was so prominent in this card, and I had just read about a fawn escaping a huntsman. So I guess I can go both ways with that one, sort of seeing that freedom is to be relentlessly pursued by Heracles. And in Heracles, when he was pursuing that deer, was not a raging madman or berserk. He was very careful, and that's the labor that took him the longest, because he had to be very cautious in pursuing such a delicate creature. And then, you know, as the hind, and there was the mention of the huntsman with his pack of dogs in the poem by Euripides, you know, we have to live free and blithely with the knowledge that the huntsman is there. There are people out there who wish us unwell, and you can't let that stop you from being an adorable little fawn leaping through the tulips. You know what I mean?
Well, yes, I think it really illustrates not hiding away from the world simply because there might be huntsmen, you know, people that are either in disagreement with you or people that are actively trying to somehow oppress you or limit you. And I think that we see that in the month we just finished of June, because that was Gay Pride Month. And, you know, some people have complained about why are there parades and all of that, but it's that willingness to say, well, I'm just going to put it out here, and I'm not going to hide away in the shadows because it makes some people uncomfortable. And so, like Heracles, it's having that courage, the courage of conviction, the strength to simply be that and stand up to that and not back down when being intimidated or threatened. And, you know, if you continue to do that, you see progress made, just like we've seen in the past couple of weeks with some of the decisions of the Supreme Court, but even in general with some of the advances that we've seen in terms of gay rights and maybe even more importantly, acceptance by people, as we see a greater and greater percentage of people not having a negative view or opinion of being gay, let alone gay marriage, but just being gay in general. And, you know, it's not letting, it's kind of the squeaky wheel syndrome. It's not letting whoever is shouting the loudest, having the last word and intimidating people into the shadows, but continuing to just leap through that field and meadow, but having the strength of Heracles to take that on. Because Heracles really, you know, could be the most amazing friend, but also could be your worst enemy. And it was having the strength to be both and the willingness to be both.
So be the hunter, be the prey, and have a good time.
I also like that Heracles, one of the main things that Heracles is known for, of course, is his sexual prowess with both men and women.
Yeah.
And so there we see the perfect expression of freedom, which says it's not about having to be this or this or labeled this or be boxed in by that. It's simply allowing the free expression of my sexuality or what I have to offer and share or who it is that I find attraction to in that moment, rather than living in very limited and constrained boxes and labels. So I might just have to try to admire and invoke Heracles a bit more.
In whatever way pleases.
When am I going out to a club next? I'm going to have to just invoke
Heracles. Go to the gym. Heracles. That's where you'll find Heracles, I think.
Yeah, really, huh?
He'll be in the gymnasium. And on the topic of freedom, you also, since we're having sort of a divination cavalcade smorgasbord here, also consulted the I Ching during our musical segment.
That would be true. And it was very interesting what came up. So in the I Ching, we have hexagrams, and it's hexagram number 15, which is called modesty, and that's a very traditional name for it, and there's a slight difference in terms of how we might think of modesty versus the cultural connotation. I Ching comes from China, the Chinese culture, and so there's a slight difference in how it is interpreted or what it means. And, you know, some of the things that are associated with this hexagram are things like self-respect, respectability, sincerity, and lack of pretension. And so, you know, I think all of those things are extremely important when we think of freedom, because there is that sense of not putting on airs. There's also a sense of having the self-respect to be my sincere self in the world, and not only respecting myself enough to be myself, but also then respecting others and respecting how they are, what they believe, what their differences are. But that doesn't mean that I have to somehow either conform to those, or I have to somehow not show a part of myself or try to make them comfortable in their beliefs and opinions by hiding certain aspects of myself, versus just being myself. And like with Heracles, knowing sometimes that may piss some people off. Not everyone's going to agree with me, but that doesn't mean that I have to try to change myself to maintain no conflict or no disagreement or no upset by anyone else. If they're simply upset with who I am, I don't have to not be me. I simply perhaps don't engage with them or don't hang around them. There's also an aspect of moderation that comes with this hexagram of modesty, and that really is about not operating in extremes. And so, you know, that can really help with finding that middle path. That is very Buddhist, you know, finding the middle path, finding the middle ground, but not going to extremes. So even if somebody else is acting in an extreme way towards us or whatever, we don't have to go to the other extreme to try to combat it. We can perhaps find that centered place and just stand in silent strength of who we are, rather than going down to their level and engaging in an opposite extreme to try to meet extreme with extreme. Another word that is often perhaps associated with this hexagram is simplicity. And it's keeping things simple, but it's also that idea of simplicity creates a sense of spaciousness, because things don't get too complicated, things don't get too cluttered. So simplicity creates spaciousness. Spaciousness creates the ability to move freely rather than to feel constrained or restricted by limitations, whether ones that we put on ourselves or ones that are trying to be imposed upon us by the outside world. And so being ourselves in some ways is a very simple thing. May not be simple to do, but it's a very simple thing. And when we allow ourselves to simply be ourselves, we often can be pleasantly surprised by how other people respond to us, or how things may not become the conflict that we had anticipated or thought that they would. And the one last thing that I will say, I know I'm going on and on, but the self-respect aspect of this hexagram, really, you know, when you have a healthy self-respect and you engage in moderation toward yourself and others, you don't lose your sense of individuality. And that middle ground is knowing when to help or help take care of others, but also when to take care of yourself, and not losing sight of that or sacrificing that just for the sake of the other. And whether that's just for the sake of not making somebody uncomfortable, you know, and I think of it, you know, like with gay people sometimes being in a situation where they use a generic pronoun. And let's say that they've been with their partner for 15 years, but they're suddenly in a situation where they're worried that someone may be put off by that. So they use things like, well, you know, the person that I've been with, or we went out last night, and then they, you know, wanted to go to an Indian restaurant. And that really is not both, I think, having respect for yourself, nor respect for the other person.
Nor fooling anyone.
Well, I think that that's true in a lot of cases, but I think that is true in a lot of cases, sadly. But I also think it is true in a lot of cases, sadly, that people don't pick up on that and just live in their own view of the world. And even if you are saying something ambiguous like they and the other person, they're immediately putting their construct onto it. Obviously, they're referring, if it's a man, they're referring to a woman.
rather than having the openness to simply think, well, I wonder who that is, rather than assuming about something. But that self-respect means that I'm going to also take care of my needs. And my need may be to acknowledge my partner of 15 years by not trying to cloud who that is by using a generic pronoun. And so that middle ground, it maintains balance within ourselves so that we don't feel constantly tossed from side to side, from extreme to extreme. But it's up to us to maintain that balance rather than needing other things outside of us to somehow collude with us or to provide that balance for us. And that may mean we have to go against prevailing opinion, but that's how sometimes we maintain the balance, is if everything is saying one thing, we may need to be the voice of the other side in order to help balance that out. So
you can't balance. You can't leap.
Well, so it's, you know, this month, really look at, are you allowing yourself to be yourself freely in the world? Are you giving yourself the freedom to express your opinion, to have the courage of your conviction and stand in a place of, even if it's against what somebody else may be saying, not because you want to just engage in battle or you want to try to intimidate them into coming around to your way of thinking, but simply because you're not going to try to maintain the peace by not speaking up or by not saying something that might be contrary. And maybe an example is how in the reading we were doing at the early part of the show, and you were giving an interpretation of a card, and then I was like, well, I'm going to challenge you on that a little bit. And that was me giving myself the freedom to challenge you rather than to just, you know, go along and be like, oh, well, let's not show that there's any disagreement or conflict on the show to people listening. Because I think it's much more healthy to see that there might be differences. And then it gives people the freedom to enjoy their differences and live their differences rather than trying to somehow scrub their differences out and conform so that everything and everyone suddenly looks beige.
There's no tarot in Stepford.
That's right. You know, the gays don't like beige.
They don't.
Except maybe log cabin Republicans. So, any other thoughts that come
no,
up
it seems around. Like the way to be free, when you were talking about the I Ching reading and having self-respect that allows you to be compassionate towards others, I was thinking of RuPaul, of course, saying, love yourselves, baby, because if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love anyone else? So,
hallelujah.
There we go.
And also I think that the modesty part says that you don't have to trumpet your differences. You don't have to try to make a point of saying something contrary just for the sake of being contrary. Sometimes modesty is, you know, I just live who I am rather than having to trumpet who I am. And that can make a much stronger and louder statement if you're simply living it.
Right on. Living elegantly. Like, what's her name? Coco Chanel.
Yes.
I don't know. But sure, she said, when you walk into a room, the first thing you see, throw it out. So.
Does that include people?
I
throw out.
It depends on what room I walk into. You gotta go, darling. That would help you be free. So it was a very exciting month, and so I'm glad to, in this time of excitement and uplifting change in many spheres, be able to divine what to do, how to make use of this energy, whether it's Saturn going direct or the Supreme Court making good choices. There's a lot to be happy about this summer, I think.
It is very true. So we encourage everyone listening to get out there and give yourself permission to simply have the freedom to be you in the world rather than limiting and taking your freedom away and then feeling as if you're somehow limiting yourself or not able to be yourself in some way.
And I believe that that might bring us to the end of our show this month, Charlie.
Ah, the finale, or the finale, as some of our listeners might call it.
and I will remind people that the Amethyst Oracle is on the second Tuesday of every month, and we will be back here again next month on Tuesday, the 13th of August at 8 p.m.
And if they want to win that reading from you, they need to respond to what is the Lenormand project Rachel Pollack and Bob Place are working on.
Correct.
On our,
which they haven't heard the interview, they can go back and listen to it in the archives or on iTunes. But the first person to post the response to that question, the first person to post that response on our Facebook page at facebook.com/theamethystoracle will win a free 15-minute tarot reading with me, Heisi. So if that sounds like something you'd like to win, I would encourage you to quickly dash over to the Facebook page and be posting. And I would also encourage you to get on the email list if you would like, so that you can also see when all of the other shows are coming up and what other things there are to win. And you might discover a show that you didn't know was there and enjoy it, but you also might win something that you would find great value in. So thank you very much, Charlie, for co-hosting once again this month. And our thanks go out to Rachel Pollack for having joined us and engaged us with such stimulating conversation. It's always a treat to speak with her.
Extreme privilege to get to talk to her about tarot, and I'm very, 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 very excited to have that. And now I'm trying to think of ways to coax her back on already. So,
well,
maybe like a hind, she will evade.
That's right. Maybe she will just leap through the meadow in our direction. But I'm thinking perhaps when she and Bob Place are either closer to or coming out with their new deck, that we might have her back on to hear more specifically about that project and hear more about all of that. So I will wish you, Charlie, and everyone listening an amazing rest of July and into August. Not past that, of course, because we can only wish to the next show. They'll have to tune into the next show if they want any
That's
sort of blessing
all
beyond
you get.
That's right. We don't bless for, you know, infinite amount of time. It's,
no,
it's parceled out time. Very carefully these days.
Good night, Heisi.
Good night. Sleep tight. And we look forward to having you back here again with us next month on August 13th for the Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, with myself, Heisi, and Charlie Harrington. The Amethyst,
the Amethyst Oracle.
Divination with a queer twist.
The Amethyst Oracle.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows, LIVE for Revolution with Heisi Luthmers, Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Oh,